You're on airplane mode?
Oh, yeah. So, I was, this past Friday night, got invited to, there was a large group of chanichim from Bnei Akiva, and they were in Efrat for Shabbat, and they happened to be in the high school, and they were doing a panel discussion. And they asked me, I owed somebody a favor, they asked me if I'd come and speak with them whenever. And I get there, and they had a panel, and it was basically me, and maybe some of you know who Nadia Matar is. She started an organization called Nashim Biyarok, Women in Green. You know, has done a lot, you know, sort of fighting for, you know, Israel advocacy in Israel, and Aretz Hazot Shelanu, and all that sort of thing. And, you know, sovereignty, that's her their latest project. They want to get, you know, Am Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael, and declare sovereignty. And I'm not going to get into politics here, but okay. And then there was me, and I guess I'm more representing an educational perspective. And the question of the evening was, basically, what is the next generation's mission? Like, what is, like, Rav Kook wrote an article, you know, had a whole sikha, ma'amar ador. Every generation has its challenge, its mission, the question that needs to be resolved. You know, my parents' generation, the question was, where were you? You know, the Holocaust, Koma Medina. And then you had Hityashvut, etc. And is that finished or not? And she got into a whole discussion about, you know, sort of why she started this organization, basically because of Oslo. It was actually a little frightening because she asked all the students there. There must have been 150 students. They live in Israel. These are 10th graders in Israel. Bnei Akiva, Yeshiva Datit. Like, you would think that this group really has their finger on the pulse. And she said, like, basically she started this organization after 1993. Who knows what happened in 1993? 150 kids, and I think there were maybe two who knew what happened in 1993, which, of course, was the Oslo Accords, right? And so she got into this whole discussion with them about how we've lost Eretz Yisrael as the center, and we've stopped focusing on the fact that we need to continue this mission of settling Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael is the homeland, and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there listening to this, and on the one hand, I actually agree with a lot of what she has to say. I really do. On the other hand, you kind of wonder if maybe we're kind of next to it, but not quite on it. You know, I remember when in 1995, I guess, when we gave away Gush Katif, and you know, they called it in Israel the Hitnatkut, right? I assume everybody here knows more or less what I'm talking about. Very, very, very difficult period of time. 8,000 Jews were basically expelled. You know, you could debate at the time whether it was a good move. I think today it seems the majority of Israel, I'm not even talking about Chutz La'aretz, actually kind of agrees that it was a mistake. We didn't get what we were hoping for. But back then you could make a case for saying maybe it'll be better, and that's an interesting debate. But it was a difficult thing to see 8,000 Jews, you know, uprooted from their homes, not by Israeli soldiers. A lot of mistakes were made in a very difficult period of time. And there were two things about that experience that really caught me, that were going through my mind as I watched this panel, which is what motivated me to talk about what we're going to talk about tonight. The first was, you know, the news is always looking for a different angle. And there's a limit to how many times you can show the same pieces. You know, a woman is getting expelled and a soldier is crying. Like, there's a limit, right? So some creative reporter decided to try something different. And he went to the beach in Tel Aviv. And this is like 2 days after Tisha B'Av, while this Hitnatkut, this Gerush, this expulsion, whatever you want to call it, is going on. And he's on the beach in Tel Aviv. And he's interviewing people in their bathing suits. You know, you're like watching the news, kind of like, you know, right? And, Nu matem choshvim al Hitnatkut, right? Like, what do you think? And one person says, Maze Hitnatkut? Like, what is that? And someone else, and he says to someone else, you know, like, Jews in Gush Katif. Do you know where Gush Katif is? Isn't it like Batzafon, near Hadera, whatever? And you're watching these interviews, one after another. They had no clue what was going on. They were blissfully unaware of the fact that they were sitting 30 kilometers from sort of Aza and everything else. And I realized, like, the real issue of the Hitnatkut. In fact, I think the next day or 2 days later, I used to give a Daf Yomi Shir. And, you know, used to be like 6:30 in the morning before our minyan, 6 in the morning, and we're sitting there, and I come in, like I always come in, and I say, Boker Tov, you know, good morning. And somebody's sitting there, and he says, Boker Tov, Matov ba Boker Azeh. Like, what's good about this morning? And I was like, wow, you know, he's right. Like, here it is just the day after this, and I'm just saying Boker Tov, and I felt so guilty, you know, like, I should be in mourning, you know. And remember, I live in a frat, it's like a yeshuv, you know. And there's a guy sitting there, his name is Mr. Zimmerman, he's since passed away. Summer, short sleeves, he's got a number on his arm. He's about 80 years old. And he saw, I was like, oh, like, so he looks at the guy, he goes, Ma tov b'zeh? What's good about this morning? Because we're sitting here, b'medinat Yisrael, medabrim ivrit, lomdim Torah, lom fachdim me'af echad. Right? You know, we have a Jewish army, we speak Hebrew. Ze boker tov mod, chalamnu al boker kaze. Ze boker me'ule. He goes, tamshich, right? So this guy's like, okay, go sit down, right? But I realized he was right. Like, you can't just go into a daf yomi shiur in the morning like that. So I asked them, there were about 15 of us. Doctors, lawyers, I mean, you know, middle class Jews living in Efrat, for those of you who know what Efrat is, right? And so let me ask you a question. Because I feel like the real hitnatkut here, right? What does it mean, hitnatkut? It means you're minutak, right? What does it mean to be minutak? It's like if somebody walks into the room and you're on the phone and he's got something important to tell you, he says, cut the line. You're cut off, right? And you kind of feel like watching that news report in Tel Aviv, you feel like maybe we're just living in our own little bubbles. So I asked them, who here can say, there were about 15 of us around the table, who here can say that he has a friend who defines him or herself as chiloni? Forget about what the real definition of a chiloni is. If there is such a huge thing as a human being as chiloni, do you have a close friend that you would say defines himself as chiloni? Like all of us have done the army. So in the army, yeah, but you know, this is 20 to 30 years later. None of us raised our hands, including me. Like a close friend. We are cut off. And I was sitting there at this panel with a significantly uncomfortable feeling that maybe what's happened over the last 20, 30 years is that we've been so focused on Eretz Yisrael that we've forgotten Am Yisrael. Like that's how we've become so menutak. And there is a third point to this triangle. And that actually, some of you have NYU experience. So I got a text yesterday, today, from one of our students at NYU about this BDS resolution. Maybe some of you have heard of it. They passed, the student council at NYU passed a resolution supporting BDS against Israel, right? And so someone sent it to me. So I sent it to the guys at NYU, like, what do you think about this? You know, I got back all of these really good, you know, well, the administration isn't going to support it, and it's so sad, and all these different questions somebody sent to me. You know, the saddest part is that the people who brought up the resolution are Jewish, and so on and so forth, right? And I realize a lot of these people are very actively involved in defending Israel, attacking Israel. Israel is this big issue, and if you're involved in Israel, then you're affiliated. But if you're not involved in Israel, if you're not advocating for Israel, if it's not on your agenda, if you don't go to the Israel rally or the anti-Israel rally, or are you Zionist, Zionism, anti-Semitism, then you're not involved. And you get that same uncomfortable feeling. Like, Eretz Yisrael is important, but mi yodea kamochem, you know, you're here in Herzliya, you've come home, you're in Eretz Yisrael, which is awesome, but you don't have to go to New York to be in Galut. Like, you can walk down the street in Ben Yehuda and see lots of Galut, right? And Eretz Yisrael without Torat Yisrael is also missing something. And so it begs the question, like, what should our focus be? Like, do we try to do it all? Should we be focusing on Torat Yisrael? Should we be focusing on Am Yisrael? Should we be focusing on Eretz Yisrael? Is it a three-point triangle? Do you take a bite out of one of them first? It does depend on the person. What's our mission? What's this generation, really your generation's mission? So I'll share with you a thought from the Parsha, because I figure if you don't like the topic, at least you'll get something for the Shabbos table. And then maybe open up the floor to discussion. Because I think that this question is very clearly delineated in this week's parsha. This is a very interesting question, in a different manner. And by the way, underlying this question is not so much whether there is this objective ideal, but it's also a very personal question. Like, how do we figure out what we're meant to be doing? You know, some of you made a decision. I imagine you all have friends that think you're out of your minds. I mean, I could be wrong, but I know when I, you know, when I was your age and I decided to stay in Israel and basically gave up, I didn't think I was giving anything up, but, you know, my friends did. Like, you know, I had a bunch of friends that I was going to be in Colombia with. And it was all said, in fact, the only part of my aliyah, including going to the army, the only part of my aliyah that my mom had a hard time, my parents had a hard time with, was when they got a letter from Colombia that I had lost you know, my space, and I lost the $250 deposit check. I heard the deposit's a little more now, but that's what it was back then, because I knew I wasn't coming back, and I had this really strange conversation with my mom. I said, Ima, I'm here, Shanabet. I'm going to the army. I don't know when I'm getting out. I'm going to have to, I can't defer more than a year anyway a second time. What's the point? You never know, right? You know, you get that, you never know. You ever have that from your parents, that you never know, right? It's a legitimate question. How do you know what you should be doing? Where is the ability to decide what direction we take? Okay? So, there's a very interesting moment in this week's parsha. Okay? Everybody knows this story, right? You know, Yosef gets sold, ends up in Egypt, solves Paro's dreams. That's a pretty crazy story. Ends up Mishneh LaMelech. He's Mike Pence, right, in Egypt. And the brothers come down. Somehow they don't figure out that Yosef is Yosef. That's an equally crazy part of the story. And the next thing you know, they've got all their money back in their packs. And of course they have to go down, but they can't go down unless they bring Binyamin. So they finally wait until the famine has gotten bad enough, and Yaakov lets them go, and they come down with Binyamin, and Yosef seems to display an extraordinary knowledge of the order of their birth and all sorts of different questions, and they still don't get it, which is also incredible. And then they finally get out of there, and they're headed home, and the messenger of the king come back, and they find this goblet, this chalice in his back, and the next thing you know, they're all hauled back to Mitzrayim, and they're standing in front of Paro, right? Who they think is Mishneh LaMelech Paro, right? And interestingly enough, Yosef, who they think of as the Mishneh LaMelech Paro, he doesn't have any interest in them. He just wants Binyamin. They can all go, which itself is pretty surprising. He just wants Binyamin. And so Yehuda has his moment. And when Yehuda has his moment, right, he says to Paro, Ki avdecha arev et hanar, I guarantee the safety of this boy. Me'im avi le'mor. Im lo avienu elecha v'chatat levi kolim, I will have transgressed, sinned, if you want to use that word, against my father forever. Why this would interest the Mishneh LaMelech is beyond me, but okay. V'yata yeshev na avdecha tachat hanar eved laduni. So let me take his place. I will be a slave. And let the boy go. That's what he says. And everybody knows what happens next. And that pasuk is essentially, how can I pen my father will die? How can I can't do it? And this moment, pitom, Yosef litapek, Yosef can't hold it in anymore. And he lets out a wail, ha'od avichai, and the rest is history. And there are two interesting questions about this moment. The one question, which maybe we'll get to tonight, maybe we won't, is what about this question suddenly bursts the dam of Yosef's resolve? But there's another interesting question, which is who says Yehuda has a right to do this? I mean, being sold as a slave in Egypt, you know, the Mefarshim discuss, the commentators discuss whether or not the brothers... Why is it that when you kidnap someone, you're liable for that crime pretty much the same as murder? And were the brothers liable for murder? There's a famous midrash, you know, that has possibly Antoninus, Turnus Rufus, you know, speak to the, if you look at it, it's quoted to some degree in the Asara Haruge Malchot, in the Eliezer, the B'Siyan Yom Kippur, right? Where the evil ruler comes to these great rabbis and says to them, you know, who paid for the sin of Yosef? Nobody did. Therefore, you have to accept the verdict. Now, the brothers didn't kill Yosef. Why are these rabbis sentenced to death? So the traditional answer is because selling Yosef into Egypt was a death sentence. Right? Which makes sense. It's clear the brothers wanted to kill him. Then they throw him in a pit, which at least midrashically is full of snakes and scorpions. So he should have died. You sell a person back into Egypt. I mean, I remember we were in Poland. And we have an amazing tour guide, and you know, it's the little details that get to you. And we were walking down this long hall. Has anybody here been to Poland, been to Auschwitz? You've been to these places? So when you go to Auschwitz, there's this long, you go down into the torture chamber down there in the bottom of all these horrible cells, and there's a long hall. And on the hall are photographs in frames. And they're photographs of actual inmates. The Nazis documented all these prisoners, certainly early on. And every prisoner had a photograph, right? Which I never knew. And you look at these people's faces, like you can just see some of them are beaten, right? And it tells you when they came and it tells you when they died. And you couldn't find any of them that were there longer than 3 months. If you found them was there for 5 months, that was unbelievable. You didn't. The life expectancy for an inmate who wasn't sent to the gas chambers in Auschwitz was approximately 3 weeks. It was unbelievable for someone to survive 3 months when you consider the conditions and the horror and the random killings. Why would ancient Egypt have been any different? They worked them to death. They threw them into slave pits. And that's where Binyamin is going. So who says Yehuda has the right? Erev Tov, don't come on in. Who says Yehuda has the right to do that? You know, I remember this was in 2001. Some of you may remember there was a second intifada. And we were Miluim, and it was the most difficult Miluim I ever had, only because you just didn't expect it. You didn't understand, like, you know, you're doing patrols, you think it was like Intifada, and all of a sudden you're getting into gun battles, and it was right near our house. It was very difficult, so like you would come home for a couple hours, tuck the kids into bed, then your radio would squawk, and you'd go off and patrol and get shot, and it was a crazy, crazy experience. And I remember one day we got a call, there was shooting on the road, on the tunnel road, near El Khader, if that says anything to you. And so we drive there, the chapak, whatever it is. And by the time I got there, it was pretty much over. There was a patrol that got ambushed by Palestinian gunmen. And they were shooting on the road. And this patrol got there and realized that the only way to stop the shooting on the road was to take this position. Right? And there were civilians there. There were cars passing by. They stopped the traffic, but they were still within range. So in retrospect, the Palestinians had this well planned. And they opened up with a heavy machine gun from an advantageous strategic high point. And they killed two of the boys, and one of them was wounded. The next vehicle that was on scene was the chapak of there was a local unit of Sadirnikim, of regular army. And the Samach Mempe, the deputy company commander, was in the jeep, and he got there. Now, it was not clear exactly what happened, at least it wasn't to me at the time. And he basically did what you shouldn't be doing, right? He saw that there was a wounded soldier, and he was lying next to a dead soldier, and the wounded soldier apparently was crying out in pain, but he was in a very disadvantageous spot. He was literally under the guns of the Palestinians. What he should have done is he should have called for kochot, and they should have closed the area, and they should have taken out the position. But I guess the thought of this soldier lying out there in open territory and screaming and crying in pain, so he told his men to cover him, and under fire, he managed to reach this soldier. And he threw him on his back. This is a maneuver you practice in the army. And he began making his way back to the road and to cover. And he made it about 200 yards. And in retrospect, it became clear that they had planned this. There were witnesses afterwards who said they could see some of the Arab gunmen smiling. They waited to him to get just as far, just far enough so it looked like he had a hope. And then they cut him down, both of them. And they both died. Achim lamavet lanetzach. And there was a tahkir afterwards. Because on the one hand, like, that's a tremendously brave thing to do. On the other hand, who says you have a right to do that? Who says the Samach Mempe is allowed to go in such a hopeless situation under fire and risk his own life to save another? In the end, it was obviously a mistake because they both got killed. So far be it from me to judge a person who does something and, you know, obviously in the midst of combat, like, you can't. But now, sitting here years later, sterile environment, are you allowed to do that? There's a famous tshuva of Rav Raim Ashri. Well, famous because I know it. Rav Raim Ashri was a rabbi in the Kovno ghetto. And you write the boys, remember, we talked about him a few times. And without going into all the details, he basically had access. The Nazis had a warehouse that was going to be the museum for the extinct Jewish race. And they collected Jewish treasure from all over the area in Lithuania, and they deposited it in this warehouse, right, in the Kovno ghetto. Now, what was in this warehouse, right? So there were no golden pieces there. That went into somebody's pocket or into Swiss banks. The art disappeared. What was left there was Jewish artifacts, Sfarim. And the Nazis were meticulously organized, so they got two Jews to catalog all these books. So basically, they gave him a library. It was like he had a mini basement. And they put him, Rav Ephraim Ashri, as a guard in front of this warehouse. And he finally started getting curious. Where were all these, what was going in there, and what were the higher officers doing? So he managed to sneak in, and all of a sudden he had access to Sfarim. people heard that Rav Raim Ashri had access to Sfarim, and they started asking him their questions. And he wrote down the questions on little scripts of paper, wrote down the answers that he was able to give them, such as it were, given the circumstances, and he hid them in little tin cans, dug them up after the war, he survived the war, and published them as a 5-volume set called Mimah Makim, From the Depths. Unbelievable tshuvot. Unbelievable tshuvot. The questions are amazing. So there's one tshuva in there, there's a question. A person came to Rav Ashri and asked him, they were about to be taken on a death march. And if you're on a death march, are you allowed to step out of line if a friend of yours falls? Because, of course, if you don't help him up, you know, they had, you know, no food, no, they were living on 200 calories a day. If you don't step out of the line and you don't save this person, he'll die. The Nazis, it'll take a minute or two, they'll see him, they'll kill him. On the other hand, if you step out of line, you're putting your life at risk. Who says you're allowed to do that? Your Jewish mother, by the way, has a strong opinion on this tshuva, right? But what's halacha say, right? So it's interesting that this moment is actually what defines Yehuda. This is the moment the Medrash says that Yehuda becomes Malchut Yehuda. This is that moment where Yehuda changes his destiny, where he rises himself up like a phoenix from the ashes of the terrible decisions he made in selling Yosef. But why is this a moment like that? And can you do that? And on a lesser level, by the way, you know, we do that all the time. You make a decision to put yourself at risk. We're not going to get into the broader, this. You could have a whole day seminar on this topic, but, you know, some of you must have had the relative who said, how can you go to Israel? There's bombs that go off. They have 15,000 missiles, right? I mean, yeah, somebody had that, right? It's a legitimate question. Are you allowed, you know, the Stipler, Rav Kanievsky, the original, the Stipler, one of the Gedolei Hador of the last generation, he was quoted as saying that when Mashiach comes and there's a Sanhedrin, whatever that means, and we actually all will subscribe to Halacha and we'll all want to follow Halacha, that'd be enough of a miracle. He says he thinks the Sanhedrin is going to outlaw cars. Because you put your life in your hands in this country every time you get in a car. We're going to go back to horses and wagons. I don't have to agree with him, but it's a legitimate question, right? So who says you're allowed to do this, right? Why and how does this work? Okay, the Shulchan Aruch, by the way, in Choshen Mishpat, the Shulchan Aruch paskins lalacha in Simen Tav Chaf Hei, which would be 425, right? Sif Bet. Ein dochin nefesh mitnei nefesh. You can't kill one person to save another. And there's a well-known Gemara. I'm going to go short rather than long, just judging by, you know, sort of where we are and what your schedules are. But, you know, the Gemara has a whole discussion about this. Are you allowed to you know, the most famous case is if you're under siege and the enemy says, give us, I don't know, Zach Hirschfuss, we want him. And if you don't give us Zach Hirschfuss, we're going to kill everybody. And they mean it. And let's say for whatever reason you believe what they say is true. So there's a whole discussion in the Gemara. Well, what if Zach Hirschfuss is a murderer? And he's going to be put to death anyway. All right, so, you know, whatever. They get a discount, right? So the clear halacha is, you're not allowed to give him over. Even if it means you're all going to be killed, because they're the killers, you can't be a killer. Right? And certainly, if they say, give over this person or we'll kill you. Right? So, how do you decide? And the expression in the Gemara, right? The expression in the Gemara... No, this is wrong. It's on Chafei. Hang on. Sorry. Expression in the Gemara. I think it's on Daf Chafei. Yeah. The expression in the Gemara is, Ki ahu da'ata l'kameh d'rava amr le mari d'urai amr zil katle l'planya. This robber told me that I have to go kill so-and-so. Ve'ila o katlina lach. And if not, he's going to kill me. Right? Either I kill you, you kill me. So this is the famous discussion, right? You know, Yarek Valyavor, right? Amrle liklucha velo tiktol, my chazit de dama didach, sumak tfei, dilma dama dehu gavra sumak tfei. Who says that your blood is redder than his? Maybe his blood is redder than yours. So, Varshim say that that logic, the reverse of that logic, is the same thing. How can you give up your life? Who says that his blood is redder than, maybe your blood is redder, right? And this is based, by the way, on the pasuk in Vayikra. There's a pasuk in Vayikra, Pasuk says, "Asher yaseh otam adam v'chay b'hem." Right, you have to live by them. Everybody knows this is a famous gemara, right? Right, this is in Perek Yud Chet Pasuk Hey. Okay, in Acharimot. Right, so if you need a good dvar Torah for Acharimot, this is the one to go with. So somebody tell me, what does v'chay b'hem mean? Anybody remember the line in the gemara? V'chay b'hem v'lo shiyamut b'hem. Right, okay. It says v'chay b'hem that you're supposed to live by these laws, and therefore, if somebody tells you eat treif or I'm going to kill you, you're supposed to eat treif, right? And certainly, if somebody tells you kill someone, so then, you know, that must be an exception to this rule. But listen to what Rashi says here: v'chay b'hem, that the Torah is meant to live by. You're not supposed to die for it. That's what Rashi says. Rashi says le'olam haba. It's not talking about living in this world. It's not saying that you have a responsibility. Hashem gave you a life to live, and better to transgress one mitzvah rather than die. Right? Rashi quotes the Medrash and says, "L'olam haba, she'im tomar b'olam hazeh ve'lo sofo umet." Anyway, you can't say that this pasuk says Rashi is talking about that in this world that I'm meant to live, and therefore I should eat treif rather than die, because you're going to die eventually anyway. That's a crazy Rashi. The Ramban points out this Medrash, and then quotes the Gemara that we discussed, that a person is supposed to live by it. And just to finish off the source material, the Rambam talks about this. The Rambam in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, right? So there's a whole perek on this topic, Perek Hay, which is a fascinating perek to study. By the way, word to the wise, Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah is the first set of halachot in the first book of the entire magnum opus of the Rambam. Okay? It is literally the foundations of Judaism, foundations of Torah. And clearly the Rambam's perception is, before we can talk about halacha and what we're supposed to do, we have to understand why we're doing it. Right? And if you decide to pursue this, my advice is, it's not so simple. The first two prakim in Sotei Torah are not easy, because they're the deep theological, philosophical, existential questions of God, and what is God, and what does it mean that God is one. But then you get into a lot of interesting topics, Perek Dalet, Perek Hei, Chilul Hashem, Kiddush Hashem. So if you struggle with the first few prakim, it's still worth getting later on. Right? And the Rambam here says, if a person is obligated to eat treif, let's say, which is what the Rambam says, rather than die, and he chooses to die, mitchayev benafsho, you're not allowed to do that. So if you're not allowed to give your life up and you do, you're transgressing, right? And the Rambam is pretty clear. The Rambam says that in fact, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to be Yehuda. You're not allowed to give yourself up in order to save someone's life. That samach mem pei, so it would seem, according to the Rambam, was actually mistaken. On the other hand, Kesef Mishnah, anybody know who wrote the Kesef Mishnah? Kesef Mishnah was written by the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, so he's a big honcho, right? And the Kesef Mishnah actually says, no, it's not true. It's true that a person isn't obligated to give up his life, but he's allowed to give up his life. And he goes so far as to say, he quotes the Nimuke Yosef. The Nimuke Yosef says, in fact, even the Rambam would agree that if a guy is a Hasid and a Tahor, and he's in a difficult situation, if he wants to sacrifice his life, what's the line of the Nimuke Yosef? He says, De'afilu lefi svarat Rabbeinu, even according to the opinion of the Rambam, Im hu adam gadol v'chassid yarei shamayim, if he's a tremendous person and in awe of Hashem, v'ro'eh she'ador parutz b'kach, and he sees that there's a need in that generation, right? That people think that mitzvot are easy and you don't really need to do them. Rashai l'kadesh at Hashem, he's allowed to sanctify Hashem's name, v'limsor atzmon, to give himself over, afilu al mitzvah kala, even for an easy mitzvah, so you have stories of people in the Holocaust who refused to, I don't know, eat a piece of treif or do something on Shabbat, and they got killed for it. And the Rambam would say, so it seems, that that's a mistake. And the Rambam goes so far as to say that if a person's in a difficult situation, we don't judge him, he wouldn't get Malkos, because b'chazot he's a nus, it's not his fault. But the Nimuke Yosef says, so it's a very complicated question. So, how does this work? How can Yehuda do this? So there are two pieces in this parsha that I think speak to this issue. The first concern is Yehuda, the second concern is Yaakov. And then we'll open up the floor. In order to understand this, the reasoning that Yehuda gives in the Torah for being able to give himself up, to put his life in danger. By the way, there are some opinions that say that Yehuda choosing to give himself up for slavery is basically killing himself. It's like, there's another tshuva. They ask, there's a fellow comes to Ephraim Ashri, and you can hear the pain in the question. They took some 3,000 Jews out of the ghetto, and they announced that they were taking them to the Ninth Fortress. Everybody knew what happened to the Jews in the Ninth Fortress. They were tortured, beaten, and killed. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They had a quarter. The Nazis needed a quarter. And they were made to sit. They set them aside in this big courtyard. And they sat miserable in the sun, you know, no rations, beatings, terrible, for almost 3 days. And a Jew comes over to Ephraim Ashri and says to him, I have a shaila for you. My son is one of those 3,000 Jews. And I have a way. I found a guard, and I have some valuables hidden in my coat. And I know that I can bribe him to get my son released. But the guard told me, he's a Jewish capo. He said, look, I'll do this for you, but you need to know that if I take a Jew out, I'm going to have to put another Jew in. Because the Nazis are fanatical about numbers. So the guy comes to Ephraim Ashri and says, can I do that? Like, I can save my son's life, but he's going to take someone else. But I'm not taking someone else. But someone else is going to go. It's the only tshuva in the entire book that I know of that Ephraim Ashri says, don't ask me that question. Don't ask me that question. But he won't let up on him. And he comes to him again and again, and the next morning he won't have that. Finally, on the second day, this father says to him, by the fact that you refuse to answer the question, you've given me my answer. He doesn't redeem his son, and his son is murdered. And Ephraim Ashri writes this powerful piece at the end about how he struggles with this question. Can you give up a person? So Yehuda says, I can do this because avdecha arev et hanar. Because I am an arev for this boy. And this is interesting. Reuven, you may remember the story, Reuven tries to convince Yaakov to let him take Binyamin down. And Yaakov says no, for whatever the reasons. Yehuda waits till they're really hungry, and then he says, avdecha arev et hanar. Anochi arvenu miyadit tevakshenu. I will be an arev for him. You can come to me. I will bring him home. So obviously, what do we have to do? We have to define our terms. What does the word arev mean? What is arevut? By the way, what famous line in the Gemara, it's Gemara in Shulos, does that line remind you of? Kol Yisrael arevim zeh bazeh. What does that mean? What does arevim mean? So I remember, some of you remember, this must have come up at Araita, so you guys may remember this discussion, but I remember when I first got married, so, you know, about 6 months in, you're going to discover this, God willing, soon, as well as him. You know, you can't live here on rent. There's no rent control here, and if they want to raise the rent, they can, and it's just, you know, and it's just, you know, it's one thing to do it when you're a student and you're, you know, with a bunch of friends and you're only going to be here temporarily, but once you have a family, you want to own your own place. So if you're like me, like when I got married, like you realize, I mean, I remember the landlord, we had this, we rented this small place. Landlord calls us up about 6 months into the lease. Says, look, I just want, it was $600 a month. That's, for me, that was a lot of money. I was studying for smicha, right? It was like, you know, get to the supermarket and can I afford a second thing of milk type of thing? $600 a month. But, you know, we lived in a decent apartment. Guy calls us up and says, listen, I just want you to know, you know, on the lease it says that I have to give you first option. I'm raising the rent to $950. I said, $950. Like, imagine you pay $1,000 rent. And the guy calls up and says, by the way, I'm raising it to $1,600. I said, you'd be like, what? I said to him, naively, oh, you can't do that. He says, what do you mean I can't do that? I said, you can't do that. You can't just raise the rent to $950. I said, of course I can do that. I said, how can you do that? He said, because someone will give me $950 a month. He says, man, he says, I want you to know, if I thought I'd get $1,200, I'd raise it to $1,200. So if you can't pay it, I'm giving you enough notice, you'll have to leave. You know? And we actually had at least like a 2 plus 2 year, and it didn't matter, like we're in Israel, right? So we discovered there's no such thing as rent control, so we just have to buy a place. But you buy a place, you don't really buy a place. You go to the bank buys the place, you rent it to someone, and hopefully the rent covers the mortgage and you shtabach shemo, right? Until you can finally start working. So in order to do this, I think it's a little different now. In those days, you had to get 5 people to sign as a guarantor, as an arev. Okay? You had to ask 5 of your friends. Now, who do I know? I'm like, 25 years old, fresh out of the army. I don't have people who can whatever. So you got to find 5 friends who are earning just enough they can do it. If you can find people more salary, you only have to have 3. We all have 5. So I got 4 friends to do this for me, 5 friends to do it for me. Okay, and of course the way we did it was they were also getting married. And when they got married, they did the same thing. I signed for them, you signed for me. We're all signed on all these loans. The whole thing's ridiculous, right? One day they'll come after me for somebody's loan. I'll just start laughing. But okay, fine, right? So somebody called me up, and somebody who signed for me. And I was quite happy to sign for him. I said, great. And I went into the bank, and I'm sitting in the bank. I still remember this moment. and the bank says, oh, okay, I see you're the first one to sign. And I'm like, look at me, doing the mitzvah right away. It's the reason I'm doing the mitzvah. I said, yeah, happy to do it, right? So he says, okay, you understand what this means. I said, yeah, I'm signing on my friend's loan. He says, you understand the bank can come and demand this loan if he doesn't pay. I said, I'm sure he's going to, he's not going to renege on his loan, like he's a good friend, whatever it is. He looks at me and goes, you don't understand something. He says, when you sign on this line, it's no longer his loan. It's your loan. You are borrowing this money. You're just letting him have it. And the bank will go for the first person on the list. It was a healthy dose of reality. Arevut doesn't mean I'm going to help him and I'm going to stand in his place. What arevut means is I am him and he is me. That's what arevut means. In fact, there's a Gemara in Makot that has a whole discussion. Rav Nevin Zal in his Sichot quotes this Gemara. He says, is a city allowed to be divided between 2 tribes? There's a whole discussion about what it means to be in this tribe or that tribe, etc., nachalat, inheritance. Can you have a city that's split amongst 2 tribes? So the Gemara says no. So the Gemara asks an obvious question. What city do you know of that was split between 2 tribes? Yerushalayim. Which 2 tribes? Yehudah and Binyamin. So the Gemara says, there's a city that's divided between 2 tribes, Yehudah and Binyamin. The Gemara says no. Yehudah and Binyamin are no longer 2 tribes. And it quotes this pasuk, Anuchi Arvenu Avdecha Arevut Anar. Arevut means I am you and you are me. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh. You know what a really good chont is? A really good chont is Milav. You can't tell where the potato ends and the meat begins. I'm an expert on chont. We have Thursday night chonts. I think I've tasted more different chonts than any other human being alive over 11 years of Araita, Baruch Hashem, right? Arevut means I am you and you are me. That's the first piece. The first piece is Yehuda isn't giving his life for his brother. He's making his brother's life his own. He is his brother. And by the way, in this way, Yehuda fixes the mistake that he made with Yosef. It's the exact antithesis. It's the exact opportunity. It's the Rambam's tshuva of put yourself in the same situation. In this instance, instead of casting aside his brother, he becomes his brother. What's the second piece in this parasha? This will only take a minute. This is a really bizarre moment. So, Yosef reveals himself. And then they let Yaakov know. It's one of the most beautiful psukim in the entire Torah. Vatechi ruach Yaakov. Yaakov, who cannot be comforted, who says when they show him the technicolor coat dipped in blood, right? Vayima'ein lehit necham. He can't be comforted. And if you've ever sat with someone who lost a son, you understand what that means. I actually have a close friend, Zach Baumel. He's been missing in action from the Battle of Sultan Yaakov since 1982. His father died never knowing what happened to his son. His mother, you look in her eyes, and I remember her from before, not the same person. There's no closure. You just want to know. And all of a sudden, Yaakov is reborn. And he's going down to Egypt to see his son, right? And then there's this moment, right? I'm going to go see him before I die. Because he's old. What's the very next pasuk? He gets to Beersheba and he offers up korbanot to the father, to the God of his father Yitzchak. That's a little strange. Why does he wait to get to Beersheba to offer a korbanot? And why dafka the father Yitzchak? And why didn't he say Avi Avram? And then Vayomer Anochi Ael, right? Vayomer Elohim Yisrael b'marot halayla. Obviously, he goes to sleep, which is unbelievable. Vayomer Yaakov Yaakov, Vayomer Hineini.
Vayomer anochi Elohei avicha al tira mirda mitzrayma ki legoy gadol asimcha Hashem.
Don't be afraid about going down to Egypt. I will make you a great nation there. Ask me an obvious question. Obvious question. Yaakov's on the way down to Yosef, has this dream. Hashem says, don't be afraid. I will make it to a great nation. Ask me an obvious question. Obvious question. Want me to repeat it? This is not rhetorical. Ask me an obvious question. Obvious question. Yaakov's on his way down, finds out his son is alive, stops in Beersheba, offers up Korbanot. Hashem comes to him in a dream and says, don't be afraid, because you will be a great nation down there. Ask me an obvious question. Please. Yeah?
Abraham was promised that it will be in Israel.
Pardon?
Abraham was promised that the great nation will be made in Israel.
Okay. Well, you'll be a great nation there, and then you'll come back to Egypt. Avram was also said.
Why go there and back?
Well, no. Avram was also told in Brit Ben Eptarin that you're going to be in a nation, a strange nation, a strange. So they know there's going to be an exile. So that's okay. There's another obvious question. Shem says to Yaakov, don't be afraid. What's the question? Yeah?
It's almost random and like out of character, or like, why is this on his way down? The question that's being asked.
Well, why would you expect it?
First of all, why Beersheba? What's going on in terms of stopping?
Right, why Beersheba?
Second of all, why is he like, say that he's sleeping, falling asleep in his dream? And again, we don't know that he's afraid, we don't know. It just kind of is like this like random piece of like, don't worry, you're going to have a great nation, but he's on his way to see his son. So it seems to be a bit rather like, without knowing context.
Yeah, in other words, Yaakov is already on his way down. Why does Hashem have to come to him and say, don't be afraid? Yaakov's not afraid. He's going down to see Yosef. He can't wait. In fact, it's unbelievable he goes to sleep. I mean, if you hadn't seen your son in 22 years, I mean, we've all seen the movies, right? You know that movie where the kid gets out of prison or they find the lost boy? Can you imagine? Like, you know, the mother hears and the kidnapped child was found 20 years later and she gets in the car and she drives and they bring him to the border. And then she pulls over to the diner and says, let's just get some coffee. Like, that's just off. Yaakov isn't afraid. So there's a line in there that people miss. Hashem says, Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayomer, Hineni. Now that's a word that rings a lot of bells. Does that remind you anything? Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayomer, Hineni. Remind you anything? Moshe, Moshe, Vayomer, Hineni. Hashem comes to Avram and says, right, that's at the Sneh. That's the moment when Moshe is given his mission. Hashem comes to Avram. What was the most, at least according to Chazal, what was the most difficult challenge that Avram had in his life? Yakeda. What does Hashem say? Avram, Avram, Vayomer. Hineni. Hineni is a word that speaks to here I am. It's the moment that a person says, I'm ready. Like, whatever it is that you want to ask of me, you know? It's like when your commander says, Ishanu po baya, ta mukhan? Hineni. Imagine, okay, Hashem comes to Adam HaRishon, and he says, Ayeka, where are you? Right? What is Avram? You know, Adam starts making all these excuses. Vayirak, right? What was the correct answer to that question? Hineni. Here I am. How different the world might have been if Adam HaRishon had said Hineni. You know? Hashem Kavayachal comes, I don't know, to Theodore Herzl and says to him, you know, it's time. It's time. They're getting ready to butcher the Jews of Europe. Nobody else gets this. They're getting ready to butcher the Jews of Europe. Are you ready? And Theodor Herzl says, Hineni. Now, I don't, you know, paint Theodor Herzl with colored glasses. You know, there are lots of problems with Theodor Herzl. And Hashem comes to, I don't know, Avigdor Kalani. And he says, listen, you know, go down into the valley. You have 25 tanks. There's 650 Syrian tanks. It's Yom Kippur afternoon. And Avigdor Kalani says, Hineni. Right? And those moments, they're rare and they're far between. But you know what's interesting? Every person has a Hineni moment in their life. Everyone. And sometimes you get it when you're in it, but you can always figure it out when you look back. And if you're lucky, or Hashem blesses you, you took the right path, right? That's Robert Frost, right? You took the right path. I remember it's a longer story, but I got kicked out of officer's course 3 days before the end of officer's course. Right, you know, Tirunut and Kurs Matakim and you know, you do this Mechin before you go to Badechad, and then you have Badechad, and then you have Kurs Sinei Shiryon. It's like 8 months of hell. And between my English and the fact that the maneuvers were good and I was as Dernik, they said basically, like, you know, we can't in all honesty send you out to command men. You're just not ready. hard to describe. It just sounds like such a silly thing. Here, oh, has he failed the course? Like, what's the big deal? I can't even begin to tell you. And they basically said, you're free to go. And all the guys are getting their bars, and they're already practicing, and they're giving in their equipment at the end of the course, and they're going out to the Tastasach, and everybody's smiling. And I remember they gave at night, they gave them the bars. They're supposed to put it on your system and cover them up with tape, because then at the ceremony, you know, they just pull the tape off. And I'm done. And I got my gear together, and I just couldn't bear to stay on the base. I went out to the road, in the middle of nowhere, like, you know, she's a fun, you know, you remember it. Go to hell and turn left, right? And I'm just waiting for like 6 hours, like all night, because I couldn't barely be on the base. But they told me, you know, if you want, you can come back and do the whole course again. Because normally, if you get kicked out, they don't let you come back. But because of the circumstances, whatever. So they said, if you want to come back again and do the course again, we'll let you come back and do it again, because I guess the Hebrew, whatever. So you have a weekend to think about it. How do you make a decision like that? And the worst part was, that you're free for 4 days. So I went back to yeshiva. And I went to Rav Amital Shir on Sunday morning. And I'm sleeping in a real bed. And I'm eating real food. And like, you know, and my parents said, like, you know what, you thought you were going to be in the army. Why don't you, you know, come to America for a few hours, you know. And you have to make this decision. And what is that really about? It's very difficult. How do you make a decision like that? You know, you're sitting in YU, you know, in the middle of Washington Heights. Now, don't get me wrong. I respect the place, but we're in close company here. Like, really, you're going to study in the Bronx? Like, I mean, yeah. But it's a difficult. It's a big decision.
I think you're on Facebook Live.
Pardon? Oh, I'm on Facebook Live. Fine, right? You know, it's a big decision. You're sitting. It doesn't bother me. I'm happy to speak. Won't be the first time I got in trouble, right? And you're in University of America. And, like, I don't judge anybody who goes here and goes there. I don't push people to stay in a bed. I don't push people to go to the army. I don't push people to live in Israel. But you have that moment of, like, where am I? And who do I want to be? And where do I want to be? And what's the real question you're asking yourself is, what do I think Hashem wants of me? And that's that moment. Yaakov is on his way down. And I wonder if maybe what's going on here is, Yaakov takes a pause and says, why am I doing this? Like, I'm Ben Yitzchak Ben Avraham. And I'm supposed to be in Eretz Israel. And by the way, why is he called Elohei Avicha Yitzchak? Because Yitzchak, in the exact same scenario as his father Avram, there's a famine, and he wants to go down. Where do you go when there's a famine, right? There's a famine, where do you go? You go to Egypt. So Yitzchak gets ready to go to Egypt, right? Baratov, thanks for coming. Yitzchak gets ready to go down to Egypt, right? And what does Hashem say to Yitzchak? No. You don't get to go. Yitzchak is told to stay in Eretz Yisrael. The Jews' place is not in Egypt. So Yaakov is struggling with the mission he received from his father Yitzchak. He finally came home. And he really wants to go, but he wants to go to see his son. But is he going to see his son because that's what Hashem wants? Because that's what Am Yisrael needs? Or is he going to see his son because that's what he wants? He has that moment. And so Hashem comes to him, which means he's really struggling with what does Hashem want of him. And he basically says, he named me. That's what's going on there. So if you put these two pieces together, the first question is, are we living the Avdecha Arevet HaNeh? Are we sensitive to the needs of starting with the Jewish people around us, to the Jewish people beyond us, to the world? And do we live a life of Hineni? Do we take a pause to think about what is it we really need to be doing? How will we make a difference in this world? Now, most of us, including myself, are not capable of living Hineni 24/7. Like, you don't sit down, turn on your Netflix, and debate whether you're going to watch, you know, this program or that program and say, Hineni, what does Hashem want to me? Like, I get that. But how much time has to pass before you have a Hineni moment? Can you make it at least a part of the bigger picture? Like, are you in Herzliya at IDC? Is everybody here going to IDC? Yeah? Are you in Herzliya at IDC because you felt a calling? Because you felt that Am Yisrael needs you, and I actually really believe that's true. I think that American Aliyah brings something enormous to the table in this country. There's a broad-mindedness and an openness and a healthy way of looking at the world that this country needs. Then that's awesome. Or are you here because, like, it's nice to be near the beach? So that doesn't last. And that's the challenge. You know, Eretz Yisrael is not the goal. Eretz Yisrael is a vehicle to the goal. And where's the goal? Well, the goal is, you know, a better world. The goal is a world that's filled with something higher than just which team. You know, I was in New York, we'll finish with this. I was in the University of Maryland a few weeks ago. We did like an alumni Shabbaton there. And they have two minyanim, right? They have the 745, that's called the early minyan in America, right? That's going minyan. And then they have the 930 minyan. Now, that's the only experience I ever have all year where I can go to a minyan that late. 9:30, that's like unbelievable. Like you can wake up, have some children, go back to sleep, and then wake up again. It's unbelievable. So the guy said to me, so you're going to come to the Shkama minyan, you're going to go to the late minyan. Now, the 1 year I went to both. And I will never do that again. That was just, Stephen, for me, that was just way too much davening, right? So I looked at them, they said, you can come to the Shkama minyan. I said, no, 9:30 minyan. Of course I'm going to go to 9:30 minyan for the Jews that are there. You know how it is, right? So I wake up, and I'm walking at 9 o'clock in the morning. Right, you get up, you have a cup of coffee, you can learn well, it's unbelievable. I'm walking to the Hillel there, and there's a big parking lot. And I see all these people like gathered in the parking lot. And there's some of them, they have this big, what they call it, mobile homes. And one of them is set up with speakers, and they got music playing, and they're giving out food. And like it's 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning at University of Maryland. So I'm fascinated by this. And then I see behind them this big stadium. So I realize, okay, this is obviously something to do with the stadium, like a tailgate party. But why would you have a tailgate party at 9 in the morning? So I walk over to some of these guys. I'm just curious, you know, right? Always good for a new story. And I start talking to these guys. You know, hey, how's it going? Hey, man, how's it going, right? And they're drinking vodka. Like, they're not drinking, I thought they were drinking, like, coffee, tea. They're drinking vodka at 9 o'clock in the morning. I said, why are you all here? Don't mind. I'm, like, from out of town. I don't know, like, what. I live in Israel, whatever. Tried to talk with an accent, so they talk to me, right? And they said, oh, you know, there's a big game today against Ohio State. I said, oh, what time's the game? They said, 12 o'clock. I said, well, so, like, that's pretty dedicated. You're here at 9 o'clock to, like, you know, for the team. Like, you woke up early to come out and support the team at 9 o'clock in the morning. Guy leaves me and goes, no, we didn't wake up early. We just didn't go to sleep. I said, you go to sleep. He said, yeah, we sleep Friday afternoon. Then we wake up. We go out and party. And then when the party's over, we come here. And the party continues. One guy's, yo, party on, man. That's their thing. They're dedicated to, right? It's like, you have this, like, what is it we're here for? Like, what is our mission? What's the bigger picture? And I really believe that Yehuda understands he has a moment. He steps up to become, by the way, what's the word that begins this week's parasha? Vayigash. Vayigash is such a powerful word. It is always a person stepping forward to who he's meant to be. Right? So, I guess that's the challenge. You know? In terms of the question of my life for another, difficult question. Is the life that I save a life worth saving? You know, so there's a lot more to talk about on this topic, but I'm going to pause here because my wife has taught me on many an occasion that less is more. I want to say two things. I'm going to open the floor to questions, but if anybody wants to go, you can go. I won't take it personally. I think it's so amazing that you came here, that you're here, that you study here, that you took off a night to come and hear a little Torah. I think that's mind-boggling. And I'm really, you know, it's no big deal for me. I'm in the old city of Shalayim. We're like, oh, what's a big deal? You sit in the base manager, learn Torah. To do this in Herzliya, and I do say that's unbelievable. And from what I hear, this is the first time really seeing it up close. You're having a profound impact on a much broader community than you think you are. And it's really something beautiful to see. So I commend you for all the things that you do. And I'm Israel, I was lucky to have you here. All right? And thank you. Thank you for coming and listening. Questions? Anybody have any questions? I'm going to turn this off.